Vectis Radio.
Welcome to Maggie Talks To, a series of in-depth conversations with people who live and work here on the Isle of Wight. I'm here with JD Viet, and we're going to be talking to him about how he got to where he is today. So, good morning.
Good morning.
How Lovely. Are you?
Very well, thank you. Lovely to have you both here today.
It's a pleasure. Can you tell me, were you born here on the island?
No. I was born in Canneries in St. Lucia.
All right.
Yeah, so that's where my family are from. And I was born over there and come over back to the UK when I was really little.
Really little?
Yes, titchy baby.
All right.
Yeah, and I'd grown up most of my child life in London.
Right.
And then, yeah.
Did you go to school in London?
I did. I went to multiple schools in London. I didn't go to school until I was around maybe six or so. So I started in like year three.
Right.
And started in one school, couldn't get on there, went to another school, and then finally settled at Christchurch Bentinck in London, just off Edgware Road.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, and then I stayed there, then went through the kind of conventional education cycle. So went on to Quinton Kenniston School in St. John's Wood. It's called something different now, but yeah, so I was there, and then I went to college, City of Westminster in London.
All right.
And that's where I kind of went into the art industry. So I studied digital design and development. It was with a games design course.
So what did that involve?
I wanted to make, well, cinematics for games. And I didn't really, I've always loved comic books and things like that, and manga and things. So yeah, studying there was interesting, eye-opening, and put me on the path to go to university. So I studied animation arts and illustration at UCA Maidstone.
Was it hard?
No. I think it's difficult. University is was away like from parents and had a fresh new circle of friends. So, no, it wasn't hard. It probably should have been. University, it didn't feel hard per se, other than when it come to dissertation writing,
right,
and
yes,
final major projects. But me and myself,
you've got to do 50,000 words or something, or 500 pages.
It was lengthy. I think I ended up with like a 60-odd page document for my final dissertation. It wasn't actually received well. It was around technological advancements in the film industry and looking at things like AI and how we use mixed medium and 3D and how that was all growing exponentially back, 2012. So that was quite a while ago.
Yeah.
So yeah, it wasn't received well.
I thought it was a new thing, obviously not.
Yeah, I mean, it's always kind of, there's always been, I suppose that kind of forward thinking around technology and computer sciences and, you know, Terminator 2, you know, being the kind of reality we're walking towards, I think is always going to be very different to how the reality is actually going to be.
So, yeah.
You know, everyone's got it, that we don't have hoverboards yet, of course. You know, like
Excuse
Back to the
me,
Future.
I think
so.
We do in Back to the Future, as you say.
Well, yes, this is it. No, but I mean, it's always going to change and be something different to what we expect it to be. But yeah, I think, don't know why, but it was pretty spot on, so I'm chuffed with that.
Oh, that's good. so you got a degree?
Yeah, yeah.
Good.
So
well,
I have
done.
I have two degrees, well, honours degrees.
Can't be a bad thing, can it? You did pretty well.
Not particularly well. I mean,
you
I only,
must have done.
I only skirted
degrees.
By 2-2.
It's better than nothing, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. I think I learnt more, I will say, from my peers than I did from the educational system as a whole.
Right.
I didn't particularly get on well with it. And I think a lot of people struggle with anxiety, I think, when it comes to exams and that kind of system.
Yeah.
And then saying that, I think this is my first year out of education because I've been in education all the way through my professional life.
Right. So when you had friends at university, did you go out drinking?
Yes, very much so. I used to work for Frankie and Benny's as well, so that was a good environment. So, yeah, it's kind of part and parcel, but I love that personability and hospitality. And I think working in that kind of environment, I think especially at Frankie and Benny's, they had really good family values, you know. So, yeah, that was a good start in terms of career because I got to just talk to people but have fun with work kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it was very, not laid back, but no pressure, I suppose.
You go in, do your job and go home.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, but no, drinking as such, I think students do drink, but that's never been my cup of tea.
No.
And I have a really high tolerance, I suppose, as well. So, yeah, I'm far from a cheap date.
I like that. He's not a cheap date.
No, I think drinking to excess isn't... No, I don't condone that.
No, it's just a weird thing.
I've been drunk like once on my 21st birthday, and that was enough for me to say, nah, I'm okay. Don't want to feel like that again.
No. You don't have control, do you?
Yeah, and I think I've tried to be, I suppose, a responsible one, you know, in the group. So like the designated driver, but without the license, you know, so it was always just... with my friends, and then just kind of keeping them in check and getting them home safe and that kind of thing.
So do you drive now?
Nope, still do not drive, no, but that is going to change very quickly. Yeah, I need to take that step. I've put it off for a while. I did start to drive when I was younger, but I have, like, issues with my joints, rheumatoid arthritis and things like that, so... I think it's been an excuse more than anything, you know, because sitting down for long periods, working the clutch and the gear stick and all of that, it's just, it's one of those things, it's maybe discomfort enough, but the way things are now, I think I need to drive to be able to get around the island, especially more conveniently.
Okay.
So, yeah, so I'm taking a step into that now.
What happened after university? What did you do then?
I moved to the Isle of Wight. My mum was here. She wanted to be around family, so I have family on the island as well. So I come here. My mum lived in Wroxall at the time, and I experienced a massive kind of culture clash, because coming from uni to arguably one of the quieter villages on the Isle of Wight, I was just, oh, this is too isolating. I need to go back to London. So I was lucky. I got offered a job in the film industry as an usher at Pinewood Studios. So I ended up working there for a few years on bank, and then 3 years I was there in total.
Pinewood?
Yeah, Pinewood in Ivor Heath.
Was that interesting?
Oh, so interesting.
Did you meet famous people?
I did, yeah. Quite a few, actually. I got to work with the main people. So I was on The Voice, mainly. So we had, like, Nicole Scherzinger, Tom Jones...
Sir Tom Jones,
apologies, yes, of course. Will.i.am, he was probably the most entertaining individual I've ever met. Guy is just full of energy, positivity.
He looks it, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's such a nice guy, absolutely. I always remember, like, whenever I'd walk past, because, like, we'd cross in passings just so often, and I was, like, based around where he'd stay a lot of the time, and the guy was always dancing and vibing, and me just being a personable sort, I just... saw a dude just driving in the corner, you know. I'm just like, what that guy's doing? Yeah, I like his vibe, you know, start bopping, then they're dancing, and he turns around, he's like, Will.i.am. I'm like, oh my gosh. And then it just become a thing that I just done randomly. Every time we cross paths, we do a little kind of jiggle and a dance.
Sounds good, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I like it.
I think highlight of that time there was Jimmy Carr. He was absolutely hilarious. Anytime that gent come on site, he'd just be walking around ripping it out of everyone as he passed them. I suppose that's kind of how he prepped and just stayed on the ball and just stays, like, in tune with his funny side. So he'd just be walking down the corridor, just popping into a room, and then that room would just burst into hysterics. And then he'd just walk out and go into the next room. Like, God knows where he was going or what he was doing, but yeah.
He was just doing it.
Yeah, for sure. So it was mainly The Voice. So I'd done... ushering would help with, like, camera assistance and just kind of on-site ops. I mean, it's just one of those things where something needs doing in an environment, and if you do and do well, you just go and help out where needed.
So
I managed to see and explore quite a lot while I was there.
Sounds good, I had
a good team around me as well that were really kind of, like, encouraging and supportive. Yeah.
Can't be bad, can it?
But yeah, no, Pinewood was a lot of fun, I think, because I got to experience a lot, and I didn't really, I think it's the creme de la creme. When you come out of university to get a job in the film industry, it's like amazing.
Yeah.
But I suppose I was just like, oh, I'm just a usher. And then it wasn't until after the fact that I was like, oh yeah, I've done quite a lot there. And I suppose, like, people from my university were, like, asking me questions and things. And I was just like, it really is luck of the draw,
yeah.
Unfortunately. And you couldn't make it up. I just happened to, someone that worked with my mom, had a relative that worked at Pinewood. And then she'd mentioned that I just come out of university, struggling to find a job, that whole thing. Because the worst thing ever is you finish university, apply for a job, and they're like, you need X amount of experience.
Yeah.
And you're just kind of like, but how do I get the experience if no one will give me a chance, you know?
It's a catch 22, isn't it?
Yeah, so I was quite lucky like that.
And, so
yeah.
Are you still in contact with Will.i.am?
No, hardly. No, not at all. I think I do know a few celebrities, but just randomly. I suppose it's perks of like growing up in London. Yeah. I suppose you like grow up with people and then they become famous and yeah. things like that. But yeah, no, I think I had kept contact with some people, but then numbers change and yeah. Yeah, you just lose them. It's just meet them in passing one day, maybe.
You never know, do
never
you?
Never know.
Because Will.i.am seems to be quite personable himself, doesn't he?
He is, yeah. He's just so kind. Yeah, he has time for people and that stands out. Because I think in that environment, you know, there's celebrities coming and going throughout the day. And there's a clear distinction between the people that are there for work and the people that are there as themselves. And we'll just give you time. Yeah. And if they're on the clock, you know, they're gutted that they have to leave promptly. But, you know, they still make that time where they can. And it does. Yeah, I think it means a lot when you have that kind of personability to someone who's in the public eye.
Yes.
Mm.
We're going to take a break now for some adverts and then we'll be back.
Vectis Radio.
After The Voice, what happened?
So I've done a few other shows and films.
Such as?
So a few of them didn't ever make it to air.
It doesn't matter,
so it's just like random. So they'd be like working titles and things. But I'd done like some like ad queuing and stuff while I was there. I was pretty much a glorified...
What's ad?
Oh, so you have like a massive like 50-plus like track channel and mixer and basically, you just got a cute ads.
Oh,
it was
right.
The worst, and the pressure was just so intense because you have to do it like to the second.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I'd done some obs, and then I had to sit in a room for like an extended period of time. I was like, I really don't like this at all. So the second I had the option to jump on to carry some big power cables to another site, I was like, yeah, I'll do that. Absolutely. It was like the task because these cables and wires are just so heavy and just industrial size. I was like, I'll do it all day, whatever you need. And I ran it through into this site and there was like a massive piece of like, maybe like fiberglass, like a good like 10-foot height or something. And there was a whole load of artists and stuff around and they were like assessing this build, which was going to be for Maleficent. So,
right,
yeah, it was like a mountain range that they were developing. And so I was just running cables for ages. And then it was a case of, oh, can you sweep this up? Or can you just like do this? Can you spray that? And then like by being there and being proactive, you just get tasked with all these cool kind of random jobs. So yeah, so by proxy, just worked on some cool films. There was like, Maleficent. That was cool.
Yeah.
The new Star Wars, I've done some bits on as well. I say the new one. This was like episode 7 at the time. And they were doing like a whole load of underwater filming while I was there. They had like this big fish tank kind of thing, and it needed to be like kind of maintained, prepped, and make sure it was like still reflective and
didn't
the lens
have to
could
get
pass
in,
through definitely like when it was all drained and everything, the cleaning duties of that were not pleasant, but yeah, like things like that. I think being in the environment, proactive and just willing to work on things, you open yourself up to a lot of experiences.
Yeah.
So I got to work with some really cool people, you know, if like fetching water for Jessie J, you know, went, you know, some FaceTime with her absolutely amazing makeup artist. So there was this lady called Faye Sawyer who used to do Jessie J's makeup and she was just an absolute gem and just so kind of on what she was doing. She was like a font of information, just lived and breathed makeup art and design and light aesthetics. And that's like probably the tip of the iceberg when it comes to her, but she gave me some time as well to just kind of be that fresh graduate kind of, oh, can I ask some questions kind of thing, you know? But it's all just like passing to them, you know? I doubt very much if I met anyone that I worked with for a good body of time, now they'd remember me.
Well, how old were you then?
Oh, I was just fresh out of uni, so I was like 21.
All right.
Yeah, 21, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed. And that's probably what they'll remember
most.
Rearing
to go and do
stuff. I was just like keen to get stuck in. I was like, oh, look at this. I mean, at first I was just like, oh, I'm just doing bits and pieces, like ushering, didn't think it was a big deal. And then you get on site and then it's just immediately a big deal because they run a very tight ship over there. But it was a great place to work and get experience.
Time is money, isn't it?
Very much so. Yeah, I think there's no dragging your heels in an environment like that, or kind of, like, you do what you need to do and do it just amazingly and you can kind of stay.
And what happened after that?
After that, I found the environment itself was, I think, it's a good way to put it, like, not best for myself, character building wise.
Right.
So I'd met my partner, who's my now wife, and it kind of, there was a moment where I was working like long hours, working late, working really sporadically, and just not being like the best version of myself for my future partner. So I was like, you know, we want to settle down, have kids one day. Let's not kind of sleep on that and proactively, you know, seek that out. And we'd met when I was still based on the Isle of Wight. And when I moved over to London, I initially stayed with her.
Yes.
So, yeah, we decided to come back to the island because that's kind of where we fell in love, kind of thing.
Oh.
Yeah. So, so we
how
left.
Romantic.
It was actually. It was really sweet. It's like fairy tale type thing.
Did you get down on one knee?
So that's quite funny, actually. Yes. So we actually got engaged once I was in London. So that was like in the March. We only got on together in the November because I was down in London for Thanksgiving. And we'd gotten engaged in the March. So I had a friend. Oh, it's a little bit embarrassing, but I had a friend who worked at the Dominion Theatre in London. And I said to him that I've met the girl of my dreams. I want to do a really kind of cool, extravagant proposal thing for her.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to see The Bodyguard, which is what, like, my wife is an amazing singer, loves musicals. She loved The Bodyguard. So I was like, right, we'll do it there.
Okay.
So we got tickets, went to do The Bodyguard. How it was supposed to work is during, like, the intermission when everyone gets up and stuff, I was going to get taken on stage and then do the proposal, what it was required, no one was there kind of thing. apparently, when I'm really nervous, I fall asleep.
Right.
And we got there. It was all going perfectly. Sat down, enjoyed the show. And I was so nervous about the proposal, I fell asleep. Missed my cue.
Oh, dear.
And just woke up to my friend standing down the aisle, kind of being like, what the heck? You know, not so many kind words. You know, what have you done? So I excused myself to go to the toilet just as the second half was about to start. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. Like, what can we do? He's like, don't panic. It's fine. Right. Before the show ends, you're going to have to miss the end of the show. Come back, meet me here. I'll take you onto the stage and then you can do your thing. Meet the cast, crew. It'll be lovely. All romantic stuff like that. I was like, okay, cool.
So you fell asleep again?
I fell asleep again. And woke up in a hot sweat. My friend is absolutely livid with me. So I've gone, run up. He's like, I don't know what you're doing. This is not going well. Just grab me the bringer now kind of thing. So I was like, oh, I had to kind of blag it. I can't remember exactly what I'd said to her, but I made some weird excuse to get her up to go, like, come down onto the stage area. And bless her, she was so mystified by the experience. She was looking at the environment and, like, the decorations and stuff. That journey, just walking down the stage, took so long. And we got there and everyone was kind of cleared out at this point. So, like, people were already exiting. So lost the kind of big standing ovation crowd thing. Put my hands up to it. My own fault. I've tried to work on it since this random bouts of sleeping. So yeah, we're on the stage and just as, like, the cast and crew have kind of, like, gone to wardrobe and everything, we're there and the curtains are shut. And then I was just so nervous. I can't even remember what I said. The words must have just fell out of my mouth in the worst awkward way. And then I got on my knee and then she just knew then what happened. My friend, like, done the curtain thing and there were still people there that saw what was happening on the stage. And the second I'd done that, like, it was just, it was like dead silent, you know, and I'd done like the whole speech, told her how much I loved her, and then like showed her the ring, and then she was like, yes. And then like people started clapping and it just broke the illusion. I was like, oh my God, there's still people here. Then I got mega shy and embarrassed. But yeah, that was the whole thing. I virtually ran out of the meeting because I was so embarrassed, so excited at the same time.
At least she
said
yes.
She did, yeah. So I was so blessed for that, absolutely. But yeah, so that was that. So we had a picture taken and yeah, it was just a lovely experience to do, I think. I suppose it is quite grandiose. Not the detail that I've just let the whole world know now, because I'd like, when I talk about it, I leave a lot of that out. Oh, it was amazing. Yeah, I got down on one knee at the Dominion. No, it was very much a hodgepodge experience.
But because you fell asleep.
We enjoyed it twice. Oh my gosh, so embarrassing. So yeah. So whenever I'm extra nervous though, I just make sure I dose up on caffeine, live on the stuff.
So when you got married, did you fall asleep because you were nervous?
No, actually. I wasn't nervous when I got married. It was like a whirlwind.
Yeah,
I was really blessed. So I had a lot of my volunteer team and people in the community kind of work together to make my wedding even happen. So my mentor at the time, so I used to work at Aspire Ride.
Yeah.
And I was mentored by now Reverend Heath Monaghan.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a conversation with him. I was like, look, I've been engaged for, how many years was it? It must have been maybe like 8 years at this point. No, 5 years at this point. I was like, I need to do this wedding thing, Heath. What should I do? He's like, oh, I know just the guy. And he gave a phone call up to the Reverend who was based up at All Saints Church. He was like, so, you know, I've got this, my apprentice, he wants to get married, you know, can he come to your church, have a chat, that kind of thing. And yeah, met him, spoke to him, because we weren't affiliated with a church mm-hmm. and everything, so we wanted to have a church wedding. Went through that whole scheme of work, and it was like from then, that phone call, like, you know, I had like volunteers being like, oh, you get mad, how exciting, you know, I'll do your flower arrangement, and oh yeah, I'm really good at decorating, or I know someone that can do this, or someone that bake a cake, and it just all come together. And I actually had my reception at the in the community hall at Aspire.
Right.
And I had a music studio at the time, so we had like karaoke, we had like nice spread, and it was just really nice, because I was like, the people that I was working with were all part of the wedding, you know, and just them, and they've been a part of my life, like family life as well, just forever, because they were there when we were getting married, involved in the wedding, and then when I had my little ones, like, they printed out an ID badge for him. He was like 8 months old, you know, we had a big barbecue. So it was a really nice community feel, you know, it's nice.
That's nice.
Yeah, so, and yeah, and it was, I mean, working in the third sector is not notoriously well paying. So it was great that everyone coming together. It was just like really, we didn't break the bank on a big magical wedding.
No.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes that's just as good, isn't it?
Yeah,
than spending
absolutely.
Thousands and thousands.
But then it's like really cool things as well. So I had one of the volunteers that I was working with at the time, my surrogate grandma, as it were, Helen Blake, who runs the aviation museum now. She was an absolute godsend on the day. Not only did she coordinate the group, you know, volunteers and decorate the community hall just so beautifully, but she also secured like a wedding vehicle. It was like an old school, call it like a Bugsy Malone car.
All right.
It was like, do you know the type I mean? Like, so
with
it was,
running boards and everything.
Yeah, yeah. It was beautiful. And it was either that or a tank. I was this close to the tank. But but yeah, so yeah, we had another friend who done photography for us. He's sadly passed, but yeah, he done a whole kind of photography spread and literally stopped traffic on the pier and ride just so we could have some like picture perfect moments, because it was cloudy kind of day. We got married in March, and then there was just a beautiful burst of sunshine after we'd done the whole wedding thing. He was like, quick, get in the car, we'll go here. And he just took us down to the Esplanade and yeah, done a little photo shoot with us. It was just lovely because the sun was beaming through. It was such a cool experience. Yeah, getting married. Nice.
So you enjoyed the day?
It was a beautiful day. Yeah, it was lovely.
Did your now wife enjoy the day?
I think so. No, yeah, she did. She did, yeah.
Was she was there fun. Then?
She definitely was, yeah. Neither of us arrived late.
Good.
Yeah. Don't know how we managed that one, because there's a running joke that I'll probably be late to my own funeral, to be honest.
It won't matter, will it? So you got married.
Mm.
And then what happened?
And then I've pretty much just worked in charity, like lived and breathed community.
Right.
Prior then, but as a family man doing that. So it's always a balance, like work, personal life. I've kind of merged the two. Don't know how healthy that is, but, you know, like all my families and friends are just people that I've worked with in the community that we maintain contact.
Yeah.
You know? It's just like, yeah. So, yeah, it's nice because my little ones, I mean, they've grown up in the community. When just before they were born, I was developing the soft play at Aspire. And it was great because from the moment they were born, they've had access to that. Yeah. Great community resource, you know.
So how old are they now?
So my oldest, he's just about to turn 8 on the 25th of June. And my youngest, well, youngest that's here now is going to be 7 in October. But mm-hmm. I have one on the way in a few weeks.
Oh, wow.
5-week countdown.
Do we know what it is?
It's another boy.
Right.
Somehow. Yeah. So, yeah. Then you've got a 5-a-side football team.
Nearly, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So we've got 2 boys, 1 on the way. And yeah, I think it's just because I've always worked kind of long hours, but there's a lot of socializing involved in that as well, yes. Especially in my capacity at Aspire. So I was like head of people and culture, so it was like very much public facing, engaging, collaborative, you know, for a long time.
Yeah.
But I've always been very much operational. An operational manager. That was my last qualification was in that. So I had I just finished an apprenticeship with HTP, I want to say last year. It was like the year before. It was like the end of the year. Graduated from there, a level 5 at operational management.
Can't be bad, can it?
Yeah.
Does that involve a thesis?
Yeah.
Not quite so long though, I bet.
I think if it did, I can't honestly remember. The worst part of that whole course was securing my maths qualification. Maths is not my strong suit at all. And that took me like an extra 6 months. And I'm probably being generous there. Failed it like 3 times. But yeah, it was an experience and managed to secure it just before they changed the rules, which meant you didn't need your level 2 or 3 in maths to secure your qualification. But at least now I have that good foundational knowledge and skill set around
maths. Absolutely. Well done, you.
Thank you.
We can take another break now for some adverts, then we'll be back.
Vectis Radio.
I'm back here with JD. No, you were at Aspire.
Yeah.
Did you do anything before then?
I did. So when I first moved to the island, I needed, how to put this tactfully. So I was working in hospitality as well as bank work at Pinewood still.
Yeah.
So I had somewhere to transfer over to.
Mm-hmm.
And the place that I was transferring to didn't receive me very well.
Oh,
all right. I won't mention any names.
No, it's
but
fine.
They didn't want me to be their new bar manager. Basically, long story short, and kind of turned me away before I even got to into the building, touch base with management or anything like that. But I was like, you know what? That's fine. You know?
Was that here on the island or in London?
Yeah, here on the island. Right. So I was working as a bar supervisor at the time and I was moving to the island. So I was like, oh yeah, secure job to look forward to. Had a place. So I transferred my council tenancy over to back to the island. And then, and that didn't materialise. So I was a little bit, you know, dejected.
A bit miffed.
So I got a quick job as a healthcare assistant at a care home.
All right.
And I'd done that whilst developing my own studio.
Mm-hmm.
I found that balance. So I was working nights and then during the day I'd, you know, work on developing my studio and building a client base and things. But it became a thing where a lot of my clientele were overseas. So there was like a bit of a
timing
issue there. Because I was working nights, I basically just lived at nighttime. And as a result, I become really socially isolated. So I remember my mom at the time, she was like, you know, go check out this really cool charity that started up in Ryde, you know. And this was maybe, it was only a few months after they'd first like opened their doors to the community kind of thing. And I put it off. And yeah, I kind of hit a wall with setting up my studio. So I had like I had a big PC, the graphics card blew on that. So I couldn't render out any animation or stuff. So I had to, with funds I had, like cobble together a really kind of cheap but efficient PC to keep like doing my workload until I got my next payment. And then halfway through this like big project, that blew as well.
Oh dear.
Because I just overdone it in rendering it, like tried to just stretch it too far. And it was literally one of those moments where you're like, oh my God, what do I do now? You know? So I took a walk. I lived in Ryde at the time. I just took a walk. And it was the same walk that I'd done for like 10 years because it just took me to Dover Street and Ryde. And I was like, oh, that's that place where Mom kept banging on about. So I popped my head in and I was like, oh, do you need help with anything? I've seen your website is a bit pants, so I can help with that. It was full of hubris, like fresh out of kind of working in the film industry. And I met Jules Monaghan and she was just like, oh yeah, that's cool, like here's a form and stuff, like, you know, fill that in, bring it back kind of thing, but let me just mention you to Heath, you know, who sat there. And then so she disappeared. I looked around a little bit. I was like, oh, this church is falling apart. And then yeah, Jules come back and she was like, oh yeah, he said he'll have a chat with you if you have time. So I was like, yeah, brilliant. So I went over to him, like had a chat with him, told him everything I was doing and saying that I was looking for a bigger studio space kind of thing. And he was like, oh yeah, that's, yeah, brilliant. I have a whole space downstairs that used to be a studio, isn't really running now, you know, and it's becoming a tip space. So help me sort that out. You know, you can have the space, pay, you know, cover your core costs and everything, keep your profit and grow your studio from there. But, you know, help me out with some volunteering. So I was like, absolutely. And then I've done that for about 6 to 8 months or so. And then I suppose something just clicked and I got offered a job. Basically, I don't know if it's appropriate to say or not, so cut it if it sounds a bit too untoward, but he was basically like, what do you get? Like, what's your take home, you know, at the end of a month? And I was like, oh, it's X amount. He's like, I'll give you this if you come and work with me and be my apprentice leader kind of thing, and I'll train you up and, yeah, continue to be helpful to me. And I was like, yeah, absolutely, that sounds like a plan. And I didn't realise as a result of that that the studio that I developed then become a community resource that's gone on to see like multiple sites across the island now, all around youth engagement and providing a platform for people. And yeah, I kind of went on that journey. Heath left Aspire and we had a new CEO come into post and worked with them, just basically organisationally, just yeah, living and breathing it for 10 years. So I do miss the wide community.
10 years?
Yeah, it was, yeah, it'll take a few months, yeah. So it was a long time. And because of working with people that, you know, fall into dire need and in such a high ward of deprivation, it was, you know, you work quite closely with people so consistently that over those 10 years, you know, of course, you build a good amount of rapport with people that you're working with.
Yeah.
So that's a journey that I'm on now in Newport, you know, still kind of getting to know the community that I'm serving and working with, you know.
And the community you're serving now is?
Yes. So it's, I mean, the visually impaired and hearing impaired across the Isle of Wight, really and truly. So at Sight for Wight, we're a sight loss charity supporting, you know, around 1,000 islanders with a visual loss or blindness. And yeah.
What made you apply for this job then?
It was probably being in the same place of work for 10 years. I'd never been in a kind of environment for that long before, you know, and kind of I had an interesting journey because I started as an apprentice leader and then I become a centre manager and then an executive. So I was head of people and culture, head of operations, like twice as per like charity requirements, you know. So, yeah, it was kind of my time because I'd seen it through the kind of life cycles of two CEOs. And at the time, I didn't really want to be a CEO. I always thought I was better as a kind of like, you know, supporting the CEO, you know, just because of operationally, you know, excelling and working hard, that kind of thing. Like, I feel like I was good at that.
But now you're a CEO.
But now I am a CEO, yeah. It was really strange how it all happened and materialised, because I'd said to my chief exec at the time, I was like, you know, I don't want to become stagnant. And everything that I was doing just felt like it was just like autopilot.
Yes.
I was lacking that purpose. I couldn't grow myself or the things that I wanted to grow in the way that I wanted to or feel like they needed to.
Yeah.
It was kind of a question of how much impact am I really having in the community now? You know, as I went from doing, you know, public facing and, you know, project building to, well, it was a large project that I was doing operational wise. I was working on developing the 7-bed housing support up at the community hub in Ryde.
Yeah.
And that was kind of me like phasing out of the organisation, because it was nice to get hands on with things. It was just a lot of admin.
Yes.
And yeah, I thought I needed a fresh challenge. And yeah, it was being within the environment at Aspire. I love the charity to bits and the people there, but I just didn't think I was giving it 110%.
Yeah, gotcha, yeah.
So I was like, let me try and do something else. So I applied for another job somewhere that wasn't successful. And I thought, oh, this would be a good way to stress test what my gaps are and what I need to improve by applying for Sight for White. So I sent an application through, and then that's when I took on the kind of HMO project as being hands-on. Sorry, not HMO project, scratch that. Not HMO, I have to say that. It was the housing project, didn't I?
Yes.
And yeah, that's when I kind of got stuck in hands-on with that. So I didn't end up following up the application through. I was just kind of like looking for feedback, I suppose, or some FaceTime to see what would be needed, because I didn't think they'd be like, oh yeah, he'll be a good CEO. So I got an email back from the chair asking why I didn't follow through the application. And I was like, really sorry, I'm working on this big project at the moment. You know, I'm really busy. And they were like, oh, but even still, like, come down. It'd be nice to talk to you, kind of thing. So I was like, all right, okay. She was like, what availability do you have? Like, can you make this time? And I was like, I can try, but I'll be coming straight from work, kind of thing. So I was in my overalls, covered in paint, like all over me and my hair. And I can't remember. I met with like the trustees, and I was just so embarrassed because it was a conversation around doing the job,
yeah,
not really like stress testing my capabilities. And I was, oh my word, that's interesting. So we went through the process, and I got to speak to my predecessor, Lisa, who is absolutely just amazing.
Yeah.
And people had said to me when like I was transparent about where I was going and things, they were like, you've got big shoes to fill. And I was like, yeah, I can kind of see why, because oh my word, like, she was the first blind chartered accountant in the UK, I believe, mm-hmm, back in the 90s. And you know, you spend 5 minutes with her in her office and you can just see, like, she's, I won't say better, because I think we need to have a good managed expectation, but she's as good as, at least on a computer, as I am. And
yeah,
I have like a degree in computers, you know what I mean? So it's like, just seeing how she's working on the computer and just how quick and efficient she is, I was like, geez Louise, like, I've got big feet, but they are big shoes, you know? But yeah, I'm so grateful for the time that she's given me and the opportunity as well that she's offered me in kind of taking reins of this organisation and working. I think it was more so my historical journey of, you know, being with Aspire, from it being grassroots, and now, you know, it's a £1 million organization, and I've been within that organization for so long, you know, and yeah, consistently good feedback from, you know, people in that community, you know, be it the mayor, you know, my employers, because there's a work ethic thing that's really important to me. You know, my mother is absolutely crazy when it comes to work. She still works now, you know, she doesn't take time off. She's just always like the kind of over and above type of individual, and that's what I've grown up with. It's kind of like, if you're working, you give it 110% as
absolutely
best as you can, you know.
Yeah. So are you enjoying it here?
Loving it. There's nothing better than working with that sense of passion and purpose, you know. When you finish the day, that's the difference between working in hospitality. You know, have fun in the moment and you can serve people, but you're meeting people's needs. When you work for charity, you're literally having an impact in people's lives.
Yes.
And you have to control how positive that impact is.
Yeah.
And I think because the community has been a part of my life since being on the island, you know, as I said, like with the wedding and with my little ones, you know, I think it's ingrained in me that the island is very small in the grand scheme of things, you know. And there's only so many people, I think 142,000, something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
And how great would that be to know each of those individuals by name?
Yeah.
But more than that, how great is it
I
that you're able...
I think it would blow your brain.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I'm terrible with names as well. But it's like the fact that you can just work with people. Everyone's on their own journey, right? And
yeah.
People need help. And if you're not helping people, what are you doing? No,
yeah.
People help in different ways. You know, they'll donate to charity. They'll give their time to charity, you know. But I think, yeah, I couldn't be anywhere else. Like a standard 9 to 5, just we're not flying. Because it's that sense of passion and purpose, you know. You work with the community, for the community. And it makes a better community that, you know.
Certainly does.
The children can grow up in.
So what's next?
What's next? I think... I mean, my passion is supporting the kind of underrepresented us.
Yep.
How do you say that? So I think it's with a lot of what I've learned. There's been a lot of learning in this role, no question, because working for charity in general at Aspire, you know, we worked with people with poor mental health, low household income, people that fell into dire need, you know, here at Sight for White, it's people with sensory loss, you know.
Yeah.
The charity itself, you know, deals with people with vision impairment and blindness, you know, but we have a council contract where we support people with hearing loss as well.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's a lot of learning that goes into that. But with the learning, I think it's the understanding that I've come away with, which is that, oh my gosh, I've been so inconsiderate in how I have done things. You know, it's things like, you know, on bin day, for example, you're ruining someone's day by just keeping your bins out there. I'll be like, yeah, it'll be fine till I get home and then I'll wheel it in. But that could legitimately trip someone up. Same
could,
as like
yeah.
overparked like cars on the curb, you know,
yes.
Things like that. You don't think about it until you experience it or see it, you know. And it's, I think there's a lot of, is persecution the right word? I don't know. It's like there's people that need help. And as a society, we are all quite introverted, insular,
mm-hmm.
and I think inconsiderate in a lot of ways. And what I'm trying to challenge is that awareness piece, right? Because we're only inconsiderate because we don't know any better.
Yeah.
And how do we empathize with someone who can't see? That's
yeah.
really hard to do. I mean, it was like first week here, I was led around Newport blindfolded. And that teaches you something about the kind of struggle that
yes.
a lot of people that we're around, you know, face
yeah.
day to day. So, yeah, that experience, you know, the kind of sighted guide training and things like that, I find it really empowering as an individual to know that if I encounter someone who could need help, is helping them appropriately, you know what I mean? Because there's a right way and wrong way to help people, of course, you know. The road to hell is paved with good intentions. So I think knowing exactly how we can best help people, that's not a bad way to be.
Brilliant. Well, thank you for that.
Mm.
And thank you for doing this interview. Do you have a favourite track we could play at the end?
Oh,
there's one you
man.
Can think about if you like and email me or whatever.
First one that come into my head, and it's probably a little bit cheesy, but it's Treasure by Bruno Mars.
Yeah?
Because
okay.
that is my wife's favourite song.
Is it?
Yeah. Well, that's like our song, if you know what I mean.
Okay.
Yeah. But shout out to Freddie Mercury as well, because absolutely amazing. Love Queen. So either of those is great.
Brilliant. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
If you would like to hear this or any other of the conversations again, go to the Vectis Radio webpage, vectisradio.com, and you can find it amongst the podcasts.
Vectis Radio.